Have you ever paused to wonder how major companies decide where to pour their millions or, even billions into new ventures?
Yeah, I mean, it looks simple from the outside, maybe, but it's not.
It's far more intricate than just a hunch, right? And today, we're taking a deep dive into this fascinating world of investment appraisal. This is basically your shortcut to understanding how businesses meticulously evaluate opportunities, skillfully blending hard numbers with those crucial, often less tangible human and strategic factors.
And what's truly fascinating here, I think, is that investment appraisal isn't just about crunching balance sheets, not at all.
Right.
It's really about making decisions that ripple through a company for years, maybe even decades.
Wow, yeah.
These choices shape everything, from the next generation of products to the actual job security of employees. It's a vital, pretty rigorous process designed not just to seize growth opportunities, but crucially, to avoid some incredibly costly long-term mistakes.
Okay, so given those high stakes, why is this process so absolutely critical for any business, really, big or small? Why can't a seasoned CEO just, trust their gut when a brilliant idea comes along?
Well, the core reason is that investments, just by their nature, they demand substantial capital outlay, huge amounts of money usually.
Sure.
They inherently carry significant risk and often come with very long-term implications. I mean, a wrong move can tie up resources for ages, erode profits, and maybe even threaten a company's existence in worst case.
Okay.
So managers absolutely must rely on a blend of both quantitative, objective financial measures and qualitative factors.
Non-financial stuff.
Exactly, the
Right.
non-financial strategic considerations. You need both to make genuinely balanced, forward-looking decisions. It's about building a resilient future, not just trying to make a quick buck.
Right. It's about making sure that gut feeling is actually backed by something solid. So let's start with that solid ground, the cold, hard data. Here's where it gets really interesting, because we've got this trio of powerful numerical methods, and each one offers a pretty distinct lens for viewing the financial viability of a project.
Indeed. These quantitative methods are, you could say, the bedrock. They give us measurable insights, letting us compare projects systematically, objectively.
Okay.
Now, they don't tell the whole story, obviously, but they lay the essential financial groundwork.
Got it. So kicking us off is the payback period, or PBP.
Right.
On the surface, it seems delightfully straightforward. How long will it take for an investment to generate enough net cash inflows to recover its initial cost?
Yeah.
The fundamental focus here is liquidity, basically. How quickly does a company get its initial capital back into its hands?
And that focus on speed, that's precisely its strength in certain situations. For the calculation, if cash inflows are consistent year on year, it's a simple division: capital cost divided by annual inflow.
Easy enough.
But as we often see in the real world, inflows vary quite a bit.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So in that case, we use the cumulative cash flow method. We just track the total cash coming in year by year until we hit that original investment amount.
Okay.
Then you figure out the exact month or fraction of the final year needed to cross that line. That becomes your PPP.
Let's make this tangible. We've got an example. Imagine a school looking to invest a pretty substantial $1 million in a new athletic track.
Okay.
By the end of year two, the project's cumulative cash inflows reach $560,000.
Right, so it's still short.
Still short. Fast forward to the end of year three, and that figure jumps up to $1,040,000.
Ah, so it paid back sometime in year three.
Exactly. Clearly, the investment is recouped sometime between the end of year two and the end of year three. To pinpoint it, the school still needed $440,000 after year two.
$1,560,000.
Yeah.
Right.
And if we assume, say, an average monthly inflow of $40,000 during year three,
Okay.
that means the payback period works out to 2 years and 11 months. 440K, 40 kilo months equals 11 months.
Almost 3 years.
Almost 3 years. Now, the school had an internal target. They wanted to recover the funds within 2 years.
Ah.
So, based purely on PBP, this project, it would be rejected.
Right, cut and dried by that rule.
So, what does this immediate rejection tell us? What kind of companies might lean really heavily on PBP?
That's a crucial point. Because while PBP might seem overly simplistic, maybe even crude,
Yeah.
it's incredibly valuable for businesses where cash flow is just absolutely paramount. Or maybe where rapid market changes make long-term forecasts feel, well, unreliable.
Like a startup, maybe?
Exactly. Think of a startup that just needs to maintain liquidity to survive its early days. Or maybe a company operating in a highly volatile industry.
Okay.
Its advantages are pretty clear. It's easy to calculate, simple to understand, and fantastic for quickly comparing projects just based on how fast they return cash.
Quick screening tool.
Yeah, it prioritizes liquidity, which can be a key risk management tool, right? And focusing on the short term means maybe a lower chance of errors from those distant, uncertain forecasts.
Makes sense. But there must be downsides.
Oh, absolutely. Its major drawback is its tunnel vision. It completely ignores profitability after the payback period. So a project might have a fantastic PBP, looks great on paper, but then it generates minimal profit or maybe even loses money later on. PBP just doesn't see that.
Right.
It also inherently encourages short-term thinking, doesn't it? It might cause a firm to overlook highly profitable, but maybe slower to mature long-term projects.
Okay, so PBP, great for cash flow, speed, simplicity, but it can definitely miss the bigger profit picture.
You got it.
That brings us nicely to our second method, the average rate of return, or ARR.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if PBP is all about speed, ARR is about profitability.
Yeah.
It measures the average annual profit an investment generates.
Yeah.
Expressed as a percentage of its initial capital cost.
Precisely. ARR gives you a clearer perspective on a project's overall earnings relative to the initial investment. It makes it excellent for comparing a project's potential return against, say, other investment options, like just sticking the money in a bank.
The opportunity cost.
Exactly. And the formula is quite straightforward, too.
Yeah.
You take the total returns expected over the project's life, subtract the capital cost to get the total profit,
okay,
divide that total profit by the number of years the project will be used, that gives you the average annual profit.
Right.
And then you just express that annual profit as a percentage of the original capital cost, multiply it by 100.
Let's put that into practice again. Imagine a furniture wholesaler. They're planning to build a new warehouse for $400,000.
Okay.
They anticipate total returns of $700,000 over its estimated five-year lifespan.
All right.
So first we calculate the total project profit. That's $700,000 in returns minus the $400,000 capital cost, giving us $300,000 total profit.
Okay, $300,000 over 5 years.
Divide that $300,000 by 5 years, and the annual average profit is $60,000.
$60,000 a year.
Now, for the ARR, we take that $60,000 annual profit, divide by the $400,000 initial cost, and multiply by 100. That gives us 15%.
15%.
So if the prevailing bank interest rate is just 5%, well, this project looks quite attractive, doesn't it?
Yeah, comparing 15% to 5%, it certainly does. And that's the core appeal of ARR.
Right.
It's incredibly easy to calculate and interpret. It really facilitates direct comparisons across different projects using a clear profitability metric.
Mm-hmm.
And unlike PBP, it absolutely considers a project's overall profitability over its entire life, which makes it useful for more long-term strategic planning.
But it probably has its own issues, too.
It does. It has its own blind spots. Critically, this method completely ignores the timing of those cash inflows.
Okay. Unlike PBP, which is all about timing.
Exactly. With ARR, $100,000 profit in year one is treated exactly the same as $100,000 profit in year five.
But that's not realistic, is it?
Yeah.
Money now is worth more.
Precisely. Which we'll get to. Also, ARR is quite prone to forecasting errors because it relies heavily on estimated total returns and project lifespans, which, let's face it, can often be pretty inaccurate guesses.
Sure.
And while it addresses profitability, it still might overlook immediate liquidity issues. You know, the very thing PDP is designed to catch. You could have a high ARR project that still causes cash flow problems early on.
Okay, so that distinction between when you get the money back and how much total profit it makes is really crucial.
Absolutely.
Now let's pivot to the final quantitative method. And this one you mentioned is a bit more sophisticated. A higher level concept, net present value, or NPV.
Yes, NPV. Yep. This is where we really start talking strategy.
It dives deep into that fundamental economic principle.
Yeah.
The time value of money. You know, the idea that $100 today holds more value than $100 3 years from now.
Right. Because of inflation, potential interest earnings, opportunity costs.
Exactly. And NPV cleverly accounts for all this by discounting those future cash flows back to what they're worth in today's money, their present value.
This is often considered the sort of gold standard in capital budgeting for major investments precisely because it captures that strategic sophistication. NPV gives us the real worth, you could say, of future returns, but expressed in today's money. It discounts those future inflows using a specific rate, the discount rate.
And that rate reflects?
It reflects things like expected inflation and the opportunity cost of capital, basically what the company could have earned by investing that same money elsewhere, like in bonds or another project.
I see.
The formula essentially sums up the present value of all the expected future cash inflows and then subtracts the initial cost of the investment.
And the result tells you?
If the result, the MTV, is positive, the project is expected to generate more value than it costs, considering the time value of money. It should increase shareholder wealth.
Okay, let's walk through a scenario. A toy factory is considering a $400,000 investment in a new production line.
Right.
After carefully forecasting all the future cash inflows over its life and applying, let's say, a 6% discount rate.
Which is a key assumption itself.
Right. They calculate that the total present value of all those future inflows adds up to $421,240. So the NPV is that $421,240 present value minus the initial cost of $400,000, which gives a positive NPV of plus $21,240.
Positive result.
Positive result. So with that positive NPV, the project is deemed financially viable and, according to this method, should be accepted. It gives a really clear decision rule, doesn't it?
Very clear. Accept projects if NPV is greater than zero. Reject them if NPV is less than zero. Simple as that.
What are the main strengths, then?
Well, the strength of NTV really lies in its sophistication. It fully considers the time value of money, providing probably the most accurate long-term assessment of a project's true financial worth.
Okay.
And that clear decision rule positive means go, negative means stop, makes it incredibly powerful for maximizing shareholder value, which is often the ultimate goal.
But the downsides, you mentioned complexity.
Yeah, that sophistication comes with complexity. The calculations are definitely more involved than PVP or ARR. You need to estimate future cash flows, estimate the project life, and choose an appropriate discount rate.
And that discount rate sounds crucial.
It's highly sensitive to it. Even a small change in the discount rate can flip a project from looking good, positive NPV, to looking bad, negative NPV.
Yeah.
And it demands accurate long-term forecasts of cash flows, which are, let's be honest, inherently uncertain.
Mm-hmm.
Forecasting 5 or 10 years out is tough.
Sure.
Plus, it can be less accessible, maybe less intuitive for smaller businesses that don't have dedicated financial expertise on hand. PBP and ARR are just easier to grasp sometimes.
Okay, so wrapping up the numbers bit, we've seen three pretty distinct financial lenses. We have payback period, focusing on quick liquidity to recover.
Chirido.
Average rate of return, looking at the overall profitability across a project's life.
Profit percentage.
And the net present value, offering that sophisticated long-term valuation that crucially accounts for the time value of money.
Value creation, yeah.
So how do they work together?
Well, used in combination, they provide a really balanced and comprehensive numerical picture. Each has its specific utility, its own strengths and weaknesses.
Right.
A savvy manager understands when to prioritize one over the others, or, more likely, how to interpret them all together to get a fuller financial story.
Okay. Now, here's where we kind of pivot, right? We move beyond the spreadsheets.
Sure.
Because while those numbers are absolutely foundational, crucial, they're not the only thing that matters. Businesses operate within this complex ecosystem, not just a vacuum of financial models.
Exactly.
So even with the most sophisticated quantitative analysis, like a perfect NPV calculation, there are inherent blind spots, aren't there?
Oh, absolutely.
That's where the human element, the overall strategy, and even just the unexpected stuff truly comes into play.
And this raises a really important question. How do managers meaningfully integrate these less tangible, you know, qualitative factors into their big investment calls?
Yeah.
It's about recognizing that the best financial decision on paper might not actually be the best strategic decision for the company's long-term health, its reputation, its people.
All right, it's a bigger picture. Let's start with something maybe fundamental: predictions and intuition. Sometimes a CEO or a leadership team might just have a gut feeling about where the market is heading or a vision for some technological shift. How much weight can that realistically carry against hard numbers?
You know, a surprising amount, actually. While we obviously crave data, experienced managers often develop this incredibly refined intuition. It's built on years of market exposure, seeing trends come and go.
Right, pattern recognition.
Exactly. They might anticipate technological shifts or evolving consumer behaviors or even broader geopolitical movements that aren't yet fully quantifiable in a spreadsheet.
Can you give an example?
Sure. Think of a tech firm. They might invest heavily in an emerging, maybe even unproven technology. The immediate NPV might not look stellar. It might even be negative initially.
Oh, okay.
But the leadership predicts it's going to be the next big thing. Being an early mover, staking a claim, becomes a strategic imperative, even if it looks risky based purely on current numbers. It's about combining that foresight with the data you do have.
Okay, that makes sense. And then we have organizational objectives.
Hmm.
A company isn't just a money-making machine, right? It usually has a mission, values. How do those objectives influence these investment choices?
Immensely. I mean, think about it. A purely profit-driven firm, maybe like a private equity fund, will almost certainly prioritize projects with the highest ARR NPV. That's their mandate.
Makes sense.
But then consider a company with really strong corporate social responsibility objectives, like Patagonia is a classic example.
Yeah.
They might invest in sustainable manufacturing processes or ensuring ethical supply chains, even if the quantitative returns are initially lower than other options. Why?
Because it fits their brand, their mission.
Exactly. It aligns with their core mission and their brand identity. Their objective isn't solely maximizing profit in the short term. It's about fulfilling their broader purpose, appealing to a specific customer base who values that.
So those investments are strategic in a different way.
Absolutely. They build long-term goodwill, brand loyalty, maybe even attract certain kinds of employees and investors. That's valuable, even if it's harder to quantify initially.
That makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
How about a company's inherent risk profile? You know, some companies are known for being cautious. Others seem quite daring.
Oh, this is a huge determinant in practice. Mm-hmm. A risk-averse company, maybe think of a stable utility provider, predictable cash flows, but slow growth.
Okay.
They'll naturally gravitate towards low-risk, probably lower-return projects. Their priority is stability, predictable dividends, capital preservation.
Play it safe.
Pretty much. Conversely, think about a biotech startup. Their whole model might involve aggressively pursuing high-risk, high-return ventures. They're funding cutting-edge research with very uncertain outcomes.
Big bets.
Big bets, exactly, because that's their entire business model. They're built for calculated risk-taking, hoping for that one breakthrough that offers exponential returns. Understanding this risk profile helps explain why certain financially attractive projects, on paper, might still get rejected by one company but embraced by another.
Right. And then zooming out, the broader state of the economy. That's an external factor, totally outside the company's control, but it must exert significant pressure on these decisions.
Absolutely. The economic climate casts a very long shadow over investment planning.
How so?
Well, think about boom times. High business confidence, strong consumer spending, maybe low interest rates. That generally encourages more aggressive investment, more risk-taking. Firms feel secure about expanding.
Green light.
Green light. But then, picture the opposite. A looming recession, rising interest rates making borrowing expensive, high inflation creating uncertainty. Firms typically become far more cautious.
They pull back.
Yeah, they'll often pull back on capital expenditures. Maybe they prioritize only essential projects or even pause new initiatives altogether. Uncertainty just makes future cash flows much harder to predict, and the cost of capital goes up. It's about navigating the current economic currents and maybe anticipating the ones coming.
Okay. Now, something that often feels a bit intangible, but you hear about it a lot. A company's corporate image or its brand reputation. How real is that influence?
Oh, it's incredibly real. And I'd argue it's becoming increasingly vital, especially today.
Why is that?
Well, think about investments that might negatively impact the environment. Maybe a factory with high emissions or projects involving questionable labor practices overseas.
Bad PR waiting to happen.
Exactly. That kind of thing can seriously damage a company's reputation very quickly. It can lead to consumer boycotts, regulatory fines, investors getting nervous or pulling out. The costs can be huge.
And the flip side.
On the flip side, socially responsible investments, maybe in clean energy or community projects, even if their direct financial returns aren't immediately stellar on an ARR calculation.
Yeah.
They can significantly improve goodwill. They attract ethical investors. They enhance the brand perception, maybe make it easier to hire good people. That creates long-term value that doesn't always show up directly on the initial quantitative analysis. Sometimes you have to consider the cost of not investing in ethical or sustainable practices.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
And what about the people inside the organization, the human relations aspect? This feels like something that could easily get overlooked in favor of efficiency numbers.
It is often overlooked, unfortunately, but it's absolutely critical for long-term success and smooth operations. Any major investment, especially one involving changes to how work gets done, can profoundly affect staff morale, job security, the overall organizational culture.
Like automation.
Automation is a perfect example. A project might promise huge efficiency gains, look fantastic on an NPV analysis, But if it leads to significant redundancies, maybe without a clear plan for retraining or supporting the affected employees, it could devastate morale across the entire workforce.
Creates fear.
Exactly. It can lead to industrial disputes, make future change initiatives much harder because trust is broken. Savvy managers really do consider the ripple effect on their most valuable asset, their people. A positive, motivated culture can be an immense competitive advantage, hard to replicate.
Finally, we kind of have to acknowledge the truly unpredictable, right? The exogenous shocks. These are the curveballs, the things completely out of left field that can just upend even the most carefully planned venture.
Ah, yes, the unforeseen. These are those external, often global events. Things like, you know, pandemics.
We know about those.
We certainly do. Or sudden oil price spikes, major supply chain disruptions, like a ship getting stuck somewhere critical, or natural disasters.
Things you just can't plan for.
Exactly. They can drastically alter the feasibility and profitability of almost any project, no matter how brilliantly it looked on paper just weeks before. A project that seemed like a sure thing can suddenly become completely unviable because external factors have shifted the entire economic landscape or supply chains or consumer behavior.
So you can't predict them, but...
Well, you can't predict the specifics, no. But you can try to build resilience and flexibility into your investment strategies. Maybe diversifying investments, having contingency plans, stress testing your models against various scenarios. It's about trying to be better prepared to weather those inevitable storms when they hit.
So what does this all mean then? Taking it all together, our deep dive into investment appraisal, It really reveals it as this powerful kind of intricate dance, doesn't it? Between the rigorous financial analysis on one side, the numbers, and this careful consideration of all the human, ethical, strategic, and environmental factors on the other.
Yeah.
We journey from understanding the quick cash recovery of the payback period.
Get the money back fast.
To the overall profitability measured by the average rate of return.
How much profit overall?
And then on to that sophisticated valuation of net present value, crucially accounting for the time value of money.
What's it really worth today?
But then crucially, we deliberately moved beyond just those numbers, didn't we? We looked at the equally vital qualitative elements. Things like managerial intuition, the company's core goals, its appetite for risk, the wider economic climate, that corporate image piece, the impact on people, and even those truly unpredictable exogenous shocks.
And knowledge like this is most valuable when it's actually understood and applied, right? This balanced approach, considering both sides, is what truly ensures that decisions aren't just financially viable on paper,
right,
but also strategically sustainable in the real world.
Yeah.
It's fundamentally about protecting firms against unforeseen risks while intelligently seizing opportunities for meaningful long-term growth and building a really robust foundation for the future.
So maybe next time you hear about a major company investment, perhaps it's a new factory being built or a really daring new product launch. Ask yourself, okay, beyond the predicted profits and the quick calculations we might see reported, what complex interplay of those qualitative factors, those strategic thoughts, those human considerations might have truly swayed that final decision?
Good question.
And maybe also ponder, how might an unforeseen exogenous shock appearing out of nowhere potentially shift or even derail even the most carefully planned number-crunched venture?